Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. I'm sitting here today. It's a little bit of a throwback episode with my guest co-host, while Burl is on vacation. Welcome, Jason Williams.
What's up, Cher?
I love when you co-host with me.
I miss you. I miss you, miss you, miss you.
I know. I don't miss the scramble of the day before the podcast trying to find a guest. We're a little bit more organized now, but those are some good memories.
Definitely. And excited about being back today and our guest today.
Yes. Yeah. We're going with a little bit of a sports theme. Our guest today is Betsy Ross, female trailblazing sports reporter. She is one of the first national reporters at ESPN. She has a PR firm now, but still does a lot of sports reporting, has a show on Fox 19. So Betsy Ross is going to join us and talk about her career. And I feel like you two can, talk about.
I'm really excited about talking with her and, a lot to talk about.
What it's like to cover
what
sports.
What an awesome career that's still going. And the peak with her game day communications and the tremendous work they do there. And she's done there and building her company. And I'm just eager to talk about all of her journey and in broadcasting. And
I have to tell you,
ESPN. And
I need a little break. The news has been very intense this week. It's one of the things I do love about the podcast.
Yeah.
But some weeks it is very serious, and some weeks it's light. Today, I look at her as somebody like I really admire. So it's going to be a nice little break. It has been quite the news week. We are in the midst of the Republican convention.
Yeah.
There was an attempted assassination attempt on President Trump's life over the weekend. And that was an all hands on journalism kind of deck story, hard to watch. We saw it unfold on TV. So we had that. And we have the news that Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, author of Hillbilly Elegy, is the vice presidential pick for President Trump, who fortunately only was wounded on his ear. Things could have been so much worse. So let's talk a little bit about, there's a lot of politics to talk about. We are in a news cycle.
And I'm always up for talking about politics.
Yes. Yes. To take you back to.
Well, that's my passion. My passion is politics.
That era.
Baseball, martial football. Those are really my true passions.
Well,
outside of my family and friends, obviously.
So we just, not always on the Coolidges aren't always home. On Saturday night, we did happen to be home. And I heard about what was happening, unfolding in Butler, PA, honestly, on our team's channel. Somebody on our local team's channel somebody from USA Today, on the USA Today team's channel, is saying this. And I mean, I flipped on the TV and then it's starting to unfold. It was very hard to watch. You understood immediately you were watching a moment in history, and no matter what your politics, praying that everybody was okay.
Yeah.
Because we didn't know at first. Although he did get up, and you could know that he was going to be okay, mostly. And so that was a stunning moment. I think those photos will be history book photos. Were you watching?
I was. And you and I, I was doing my side job at WLW that night, because sometimes I host on Saturday nights. Talk show, a little politics, a little sports. And I happened to be, I was known that night. And
we interviewed the same person.
Yeah. And you called me and
Kentucky
gave me
attorney
some,
Steve Meggerly, whom.
Yeah.
Yes.
He gave me some great advice on just, hey, people are processing this. Let them know you're there to listen. And that was great advice. I really thought about that. And then, like, it even was good personal advice, because then my 11-year-old son Reed asked me about it the next day. We were all in the kitchen, and my 7-year-old Roman and my wife, we were all there, and Reed just drops it on, like, hey, you saw this, like, what'd you think? And so, but your advice really helped me on, hey, you got to be willing to listen and let people talk it through. And even an 11-year-old kid, like, and it just kind of was just like, yeah, like, this is an American tragedy. This is a major American story that will be in history books for 11-year-old kids, and down the road.
I know. I was trying to explain to Jack that he then came in and watched. We watched the rest of the night. I was trying to explain to him, because he's only a freshman in high school, that he will be studying this in his history classes here and in college.
Yeah.
And he's like, no. I was like, yes, you're watching Living History, I promise.
Absolutely. Generations to come, this will be in there. And so I wrote a column about it this week, just talking to my kids about it. And J.D. Vance. We want to talk about
J.D. Vance. J.D. Were Vance, you surprised
right?
by
Sorry,
the
that
pick?
Was a bad segue no, you're there, good. But
we it is the other big it. News. And you know what? We have a lot to talk about with Betsy too. So, but were you surprised by the pick?
I was not.
Neither was I.
I really would hope that it was hopeful Trump would pick a Nikki Haley or a Tim Scott or Marco Rubio, someone with more experience. Maybe could appeal to a more diverse voter audience. But at the end of the day, Trump picks someone who he knows is going to be loyal to him, who's going to carry out his agenda. And in the immediate term, and the reason why I said more experience too, is like, you have to think about that this person is going to become president, or very much become president
paving
someday.
The path should Donald Trump win.
So you think about J.D. Vance, he's literally done really nothing in politics so far. He's been in office, he just got elected in 2022. He just decided out of nowhere to come back after basically ditching Ohio for many, many years and come back to Ohio and like, hey, I want to be a U.S. senator. And it's like, you've been in San Francisco in the tech industry for all this time, and you've been this kind of coastal elitist type. And then all of a sudden you're going to come back and you're going to try to appeal to the people that I grew up around in Gallipolis and Southeast Ohio. It's like, there's a lot there, but ultimately Trump is counting on him to appeal to those folks. And so in the short term, this was about shoring up the base.
In the Midwest, not Ohio. He doesn't
in the swing states.
This is a red, exactly.
Yeah, in Wisconsin, Michigan, Midwest. Pennsylvania, is that he thinks that J.D. Vance can go out with his military experience, with his experience with, how do I say this? I don't think J.D. Vance has a lot of experience of talking to working class people, but just with his background of where he came from, I think Trump is counting on that to connect with the working class people that he needs to have in those swing states to push him back over the edge and then back into the White House.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot depends. I mean, this is politics like we've never seen before because it's so fast moving. Like, we don't know what's happening with the Democratic Party. There's so much noise on that side. We're in a pause this week. And please, you guys, go to Cincinnati.com. I know that you are, because of course we can see all of the numbers. I know that you are. But even when the convention is over, our own Scott Wortman is at the convention, and look for a lot of his like analysis and like the aftermath of like what he's seen. He's hanging out with the Ohio delegation. We're writing tons of real-time stories, but Scott's also, he'll, you know, use his expertise afterwards. And so let me ask, before we, you know, go to our guest this week, any predictions? We used to always ask Jason to get out his crystal ball. Do you still have it with you?
Oh, I do. Yeah, it's right
Who
here.
Do you, it's, let, all right, so let's game this out. That President Trump does win, J.D. Vance becomes the vice president, then we're going to need a new Ohio senator, which would be selected by Ohio Governor Mike DeWine. Any guesses?
My best guess would be on Matt Dolan, out of the Cleveland area, former state. Is he still a state senator? State senator, a longtime state senator anyway. Raised a ton of money, ran for it twice now. And got beat in this past primary by Bernie Moreno. I think he'd be a fantastic senator. He'd be much more of a senator, kind of in the mold of a Rob Portman, stately, policy focused, not a lot of,
do you know,
not
what
a
his,
lot of political bluster
from all of your,
I could see Mike DeWine, like,
that's right. So so like knowing, cause you have to make this choice, you're not saying who's the best person. That'll come out when the race actually happens. Like, there'll have to be, you know, another election to actually select. So technically the person is a placeholder. So you kind of have to get into Governor DeWine's head to understand what this pick is going to look like, because it's not the race afterwards.
Well, yeah, and still
just a selection.
And it would be it would be on the ballot this. I haven't
not
even
this
looked
time.
As I say, it's still another. There's still 4 years left on the term.
We'll have to have an election before the 6th, I believe.
There will be. Okay.
If I'm wrong, you guys,
I'm glad you asked it, because I haven't.
If I'm wrong, I'll correct us next week. I promise. But I think we do have a placeholder than a special election, because we're not halfway through the term.
That makes sense, because halfway through. Okay. Yeah.
Again, if I'm wrong, I promise I'm correcting it next week in front of my boss when Burl's back next week.
And I'm sorry, I didn't know that off the top
but
of my head.
But you guys, the news is it's moving so fast. I have a bunch of City Hall things coming for next week, so I actually have to do my day job. I've had just like a splitting headache from so much screen time, because you get your news on the screens. And so I'm trying to read everything, and then I spend the day on my own screen trying to provide some City Hall news that's coming anyway.
I would say that would be a fascinating pick, Matt Dolan, because Matt Dolan is really a never Trumper. And yet Mike DeWine really has towed that line with Trump. And I don't think it's a stretch to say he's not a big fan. And again, I think you need to be careful about, I think things have changed since Saturday. I think there's a lot of viewpoints that have changed.
The message we're hearing out of this is,
and I think change for the better,
is unity.
Yeah.
And you know what? I really heard this. So Scott was still here on Saturday, and he and I really got a lot of reaction. And I had the chance to talk to Dave Taylor out in Claremont County, and Brad Wenstrup on the phone, and Russell Mock. And even right away, they were really talking about unity. And that was literally like a half hour afterwards. Mm-hmm. Nobody said, here's some talking points. Like, that was what they were thinking and what they were feeling. And so I really kind of appreciated that first reaction, and for everyone who answered the phone for us. So we'll kind of see how that plays out. But that we have heard a lot. And, you know, anyone who's a student of history knows that after Ronald Reagan really...
Yeah.
It did change him. I mean, there's been much that's written about this, and you can't know in the next day, in the day after. I mean, even when we first saw Donald Trump come out onto the convention floor, you know, you felt like there was some sort of, you saw emotion on his face that isn't the typical Donald Trump that we've seen. He had been through something very, very huge and emotional. And so we will see.
I've been watching it as we record here. I've watched the first two nights as we record. It'll be the third night tonight. He looks tired. Watching him last night, particularly, like you could just see it in his face. He looked really tired.
Also, by all accounts, he was in the midst of making a big decision. You know, all of the national stories say he did not make his final decision until 20 minutes before. And we did kind of see we almost saw it in real time as it rolled out. Like Marco Rubio was like, it's not me. Some of the other picks, it's not me. He's like, they're telling him. And then it's like, it's narrowed down who it was going to be. But, you know, those stories of people like, you know, the insider accounts and everything. So not only did he go through that, he made a monumental choice for his own life going forward on his pick.
Definitely. Yeah.
Well, it's so great talking politics with you, Jay.
Absolutely. Always up for that.
All right. Yeah. Should we talk sports now?
Let's do it.
Welcome to special guest time here on That's So Cincinnati. I'm here today with someone I greatly respect and have come to know in her profession, and somebody I look to as really a trailblazing journalist. Betsy Ross, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the kind words. I appreciate it.
So many journalists have come before me, and it's not been easy here in Cincinnati and nationally, just making a name for themselves so that we can do our jobs. And it is much appreciated. And so I can't wait to hear you tell your story, even though I've already read your book. And I've told like 15 people this morning already. I've been on the phone all morning. We are in the midst of the Republican convention, so I'm talking a lot of politics. But I was like, I didn't get a lot of sleep last night, and I finished Betsy's book. Like, we'll talk politics after I talk about what I want to talk about.
Absolutely.
Betsy, there's so much to talk about, but, you know, just thinking on your career and in broadcasting, and you've written a book about women getting into sports media. playing ball with the boys. You wrote this in 2000 or came out in 2010, and just jumping right to it. When you decided to go into sports broadcasting, like, what was that like for you? Like, there weren't many women going into it. And what, how did you have the courage to do it? Like the desire to do it, to just go for it?
It was one of these things that you didn't plan. I didn't plan. My whole idea was I was going to be an investigative reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, period. That was exactly what I was going to do. That's what I studied in college. I was a journalism major. I had this vision that, because right at that particular time, the Chicago Sun-Times was doing amazing investigative journalism. And I thought, I want to do that. And so that was really my plan, was to get into journalism that way. I had always loved sports. I got that from my mother. My mother and I would be the ones who would watch the, back then, 4 bowl games on New Year's Day. She and I would watch the games. My dad would go hunting, and we would sit there in front of the television, and we'd start with the Cotton Bowl, and we'd end with the Orange Bowl. We'd watch them all day. So I always loved sports, but it really never occurred to me that I could put two of them together, two and two together. So I went to Ball State, and I majored in journalism, as I said, but I got a teaching certificate. So when you have a teaching certificate, you have to student teach for one. We were in quarters then. So you have to student teach in one quarter. And so I was lucky enough to be able to teach in my hometown of Connersville, Indiana. So my counselor set me down and said, okay, you can teach 2 classes in journalism and 2 classes in English. That was my minor. And I go, between you and me and the fence post, I'm never going to teach English. So what else you got? And he said, well, so Connersville has a television program. They were one of the first in Indiana to have a broadcast. And, you know, you always had the homeroom announcements. Well, instead of the homeroom announcements on the PA, it would be a 15-minute television broadcast. And the students would put it together. They'd write it. They'd shoot video, all this. They said, how about if you teach 2 in journalism and 2 in radio and television? I said, good. How hard can it be? Well, of course, never had taken a radio and television course in my life. I said, fine. So, like, I would study the book, like, the day before I was supposed to teach it. But I would go out with the students, and I learned along with them how to shoot tape, how to edit, how to write, how to do this. And I thought, great, this is the last quarter of my last year in college, and I find something that really clicked. It just clicked, and I don't know why, but I just loved the visual part of it along with the writing. You know, I was one of these kids, when I was in 6th grade, I knew I was going to be a journalist. I knew that was what I was going to do. I was going to write. I was going to be a journalist. Didn't know what form it was going to be, but I knew in the 6th grade that that's what I was going to do. So it really clicked for me, and I thought, okay, this is, I think, what I want to do, because back then, as you know, you had either a morning paper or an afternoon paper, and if something happened in between, you didn't get it until the next day. Mm-hmm. And I love the immediacy. That, of course, has all changed, as we know.
But yes, we do.
Yes, very well. So I loved the immediacy. So I went to work for the South Bend Tribune. I got close to the Chicago Sun-Times. I went to work for the South Bend Tribune, and I went to graduate school at Notre Dame at the same time and did a lot of communications work, radio and television there. And that's where I got my experience. And so I graduated on a Thursday. I got my first television job on Monday. That never happens, but it did. And as you said, there wasn't anyone that I could see on a regular basis that looked like me who was doing sports.
So was your first TV job sports?
It was not.
Okay.
It was not. It was news. But the one person that I saw who kind of looked like me was Phyllis George. No, I wasn't going to be Miss America, but Phyllis George was the first woman that I saw that put my love of sports and my love of journalism together. And that was the first time that I saw, okay, this could work, because Phyllis George was one of the hosts of NFL Today.
Yep.
And NFL Today was one of these shows that it was groundbreaking. You know, now we're used to the pre-games on NFL Sunday starting at 9, 8.
I can't imagine 4 bowl games on one day, because you have to have so much hoopla just for the one game.
I know.
And so before, after, like, you can never have 4 games now. You can only have one. It's an all-day event. Yep.
I know. So we watched the NFL Today, and it was so groundbreaking. It was Irv Cross, Jimmy the Greek, Musburger was kind of the ringmaster. And then Phyllis George every week would have a feature on a player. And that really helped put a face to the name to the player back then. Because, you know, you were watching these games and they had maybe 3 cameras and they were wide shots and you didn't get those close-ups and you never saw them without a helmet. And so they weren't really people. But Phyllis George was the first one who really did player profiles. And I said, well, I can do that. If she can do that, I can do that. And she was the one who really put the vision in my head that, okay, I can do this. But Phyllis George was one of the few, when I was growing up, that was doing it. And so...
Did you ever get to meet her?
I did. I got to meet her 2 or 3 times, like on junkets, when they would do like a preview of the season for the NFL Today. And I interviewed her a couple of times, interviewed her when she was First Lady of Kentucky, and then had an amazing email conversation with her in preparation for this book, because I wanted to do a chapter on her because she meant so much to me and my career. And it was one of these things. A friend of mine was involved in pageant work. I said, can you put me in touch with Phyllis's people? Because you always get in touch with her people first. And, you know, Phyllis is so busy. She's working on blah, blah, blah. She's moving. So I've been getting all these excuses. I go, and I'm getting close to the deadline for the book. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, I'm sitting in my office over here at Longworth Hall, and up pops on my email, you know, pgeorge@tmobile.com. Hi, Betsy, this is Phyllis George. I understand that you've been trying to get a hold of me. I let out a shriek like you would have thought I was being robbed. I was so excited. And I just got into this months-long email conversation with her, and she talked about everything. She talked about, you know, if you remember, she and Jimmy the Greek, it was nasty there at the end. It was really nasty. I mean, they could not be in the same studio together. Jimmy the Greek allegedly said some things about her husband, John Y. And it was really nasty, and she talked about that.
Jimmy the Greek, some very inappropriate things,
And so she talked about that, and she talked about how they reconciled before he passed away. And she talked about, you know, everybody thinks it was so easy, and it wasn't, because, you know, this and that and the other. And then she, you know, she's, well, Lincoln wants to play football. That's not my decision. It's his father's, but, you know, I guess he's going to play football, you know, and one of these things. And, I mean, I just got such a wonderful experience out of it, just hearing kind of her backstory, because you think, you're Miss America, ball 4, take your base, you know, how easy can it be? And she said it wasn't, because she faced the same things that so many women faced in broadcasting. And so after like 3 or 4 months of this, I said, can I put this, some of your comments together, and use it as an introduction for my book? And she said, yeah. And so, you know, I took, you know, some of her remembrances and some of her comments. I put it all together, sent it to her. She revised it, sent it back. And that was my foreword. And so she was in New York pitching a new, like almost like a women's talk, sports talk show for ESPN. She was in New York pitching this. I sent her like 2 or 3 of the books at a hotel in New York. I said, what name do you register under? Never thinking she would register under Phyllis George. Well, yeah, she did. And so I sent her this, and the last email I got from her was, loved the book.
Oh,
nice.
And then, of course, not long ago, she passed away. And, you know, it was one of these things that I was surprised how it affected me. Because my friend who made the first introduction, who was involved in pageant, she says, you have to watch her funeral. It was beautiful, you know, because they streamed it. You have to watch her funeral. I said, I can't do it. But she had such an effect on me because she was the one who really put sports and journalism together and said, well, okay, you know, it's possible. There's a way. And so I kind of started out when I was working in South Bend in television. Even when I was with the South Bend Tribune, I walked across the hall. As you know, every sports department is woefully understaffed. Was then, is now. And so I walked across the hall and I said, do y'all need help with high school football, high school basketball? Huge there in northern Indiana, just like it's huge here.
Every once in a while, we get an email. It's like, can anyone help with high school football or high school basketball?
Yeah.
And it's like,
so I walked across the hall and said, you need help? And they said, sure. And so that was really my first introduction into doing sports on a regular basis. I would cover high school football, high school basketball. You know, sometimes when the regular sports guy on the Notre Dame beat wasn't there, I'd cover Notre Dame. And so that was really my first experience, just, you know, volunteering. And somebody asked me, how much did they pay you? And I said, I can't remember getting paid for it. And I'm not sure that I did. And that's fine.
Yep.
Because the experience I got out of that, you know, because I was on the copy desk. So I was as close to 9 to 5 as you could get in newspaper back then. I was on the copy desk. So I had my evenings free. And so that's what I did. And the experience I got there far outweighed the fact that, you know, I wasn't getting gas money, you know, but boy, I had a great time. I had a great time doing it.
So you come here to work for Channel 5. What year was that?
Well, I started out working at Channel 9.
Okay.
Right after I graduated, I worked at the then ABC affiliate in South Bend, and then I came to Channel 9. Al Schottelkotty hired me. He made me wait almost 2 hours in the lobby. I had heels on that day, and I introduced myself to Al, and with my heels on, I was a couple of inches taller than he was. I thought, oh, I've blown this job already. I have just blown it. But I didn't. He hired me, and it was really the same thing. I just, you know, walked across the hallway to Popovich, and I said, do you need help?
Oh, my gosh.
You know, and John Popovich said, sure. And so, you know, when the LPGA championship was here, I covered that, and he let me do sports here. And, you know, again, it was one of these things that, you know, somebody gave me the opportunity, even though it wasn't my main job. My main job was anchoring and producing, but he gave me the opportunity to do sports on the side.
How much, and Popo's great.
Oh, yeah, Popo. Yeah, Popo is probably, you talk about sports and journalism. He is one of the best storytellers there is. One of the best.
Just a gentleman, too.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
You work for 9, 5, and 19.
Mm-hmm.
12 in the future.
I only need 12 to complete the royal flush there.
You know, we think about women in media, women in sports media. Did you ever face, people, players, athletes?
We haven't said, and we should say, that she does eventually, you go to ESPN, you're one of the first, first female national sports journalists, worked with Robin Roberts there. Mm-hmm. So like really very much in the minority there. So when we're going to talk about players, like I feel like some of the stories are coming from there.
Yeah, how can we forget the ESPN part? Going in the locker rooms, what was that like?
Well, to begin with, I always say my first my first exposure, I guess, to that was Clay High School in South Bend, Indiana, when I tried to get into the press box for a football game. And I'm looking, and press box is like half full. And I said, do you have room? No room.
Yeah.
Really. So I remember covering
when you're seeing empty seats there.
Yeah. So I remember covering the football game, you know, on the sidelines, and you just kind of, you know, guess, you know, you write down yardages as you go, and
best
you add it up.
Yeah.
And yeah, the best you can do. And okay, all right, you know, I get it. As I did more sports and as more women got involved in sports, it was better. Never got pushback from players, never did. And we all know those stories, and God bless those women who kind of took the brunt. Never got a pushback from players. And as the years went on, the players got more accepting of it. And I think just because they grew up, if you're a high school football, basketball player, and you're good, you're used to having women interview you when you're 16 and 17 years old. So by the time you graduate and you're in college or you're a pro, you have had female sports people interviewing you for years. So doesn't really phase. I think that any pushback that I have gotten has been more from the front office and from, you know, the athletic departments than from the players, because the players have become more accepting as we have gone on. And I was one of these that I wasn't going to knock the door down just to prove a point. For example, like in college locker rooms, of course, this is all before COVID, as we know, you know, the rules have changed now so much. But some college locker rooms, you tell them who you want to interview and they'll bring them out. If you ever cover University of Kentucky, at least when Tubby was there, University of Kentucky, you tell them who you want to talk to, and they have like a bullpen area, and they'd bring five or six of the players out, you know, after the coach. Rick Pitino, when he was in Louisville, you could just walk right into the locker room. Mm. You know, everybody had different rules. I remember covering a Notre Dame game. They were playing at Veterans Stadium in Philadelphia when I was working in New York. And I could have said, well, if he goes into the locker room, I should go in. And I would have all the rights in the world to do that. But these are 19 and 20-year-old kids. Yeah. And, you know, I think there's a little bit of decorum there. And Notre Dame was very good about, okay, I want to interview so-and-so and so-and-so. And they brought him out, and I got my interviews, and everything was fine. And I talked to Christine Brennan about this. And she has become a friend of mine over the years, you know, and talking about similar experiences like this. And she started out covering University of Florida, and the same thing. She went the first couple of three games. They wouldn't let her in. So she would just grab players. You know, she would see them out in the parking lot. She'd grab players. You know, you did what you have to do. And she would write the story. Well, after three or four of these instances where she still covered the game, she got her quote, she did the story. After three or four of these, then the coach came out one day after the game, said, come on in. So she almost had to prove herself that she knew what she was doing. And I said, why didn't you knock down that door? Why didn't you have the newspaper file suit? Because again, she had every right. And she said, you know what? I could have done that, but then they would have resented me, and the coach wouldn't have given me the access that I wanted. And so I kind of want to just play by the rules for a while and see what happened.
Journalism is all journalism about relationships.
Absolutely,
it's the underpinning of any good journalism. Like if you ever see, like, you know, we file suit or we do everything. Like there's so many fights I don't pick. Mm-hmm. There's so many behind the scenes things that we never talk about, like how things we did get records or we did get access, because relationships are so important.
Yes, they are. And especially when it's your beat. I mean, it's one thing if this were a national reporter coming in, covering the University of Florida for one game and then leaving. You never have to see him again. Somebody like a Christine Brennan, that was her beat. And so she would see them at practice. She would see them all the time. You have to have that relationship. And it's a fine line between what your rights are and
what you need to do for your readers or your viewers.
Right, right. And so that was a real good lesson that she gave, I think, is that, you know, you pick your battles. This was not necessarily one that she necessarily had to have at that particular time because she could get the interviews. And it's, you know, it's like doing the sidelines at Clay High School. You do what you have to do to get the story and to get the facts, and you go from there. So it's a fine line. Every once in a while, it pops up again. Thankfully, as I said, players are pretty used to having women talk to them.
Today.
Most athletic departments are used to that. They have women in the athletic department. So every once in a while, there's a problem still, and you still have to prove yourself. But overall, it's much better now than it was.
And it's, I mean, because of people like you and many others who came up and, like, I'll tell you this story. This has been on my mind where I was thinking about, we're talking to you. And this is when I realized, like, because I always just viewed, like, we're all professionals here and where's mutual respect, and you're mm-hmm. a reporter. It doesn't matter if you're a woman or man, like, covering sports. So I'm covering the Minnesota Twins beat for the St. Paul paper in 05, 06, and we're at spring training in Fort Myers, Florida, and we're in the clubhouse, and we have a woman reporter. She worked for MLB.com, Kelly Thazier, and then we had Minneapolis paper and the St. Paul paper, and so it was the beat contingency. Well, this kid, he's a hot shot prospect, pitching prospect, and it's a very long, narrow clubhouse. He's on the opposite end, and we're over talking to someone else on the other end. He steps out with a towel around himself, steps out into the middle of the clubhouse, and he says, "Hey, Kelly, how you like this?" And he drops his towel. And it was like a race between the rest of us to see who could get into the manager's office quick enough. We were not going to tolerate this. I mean, it's kind of karma because the kid never made it, and he was a really hot prospect. I don't think that stuff happens today, but I think it's probably moments like that. Cause I've asked some of the Reds folks, like, and they're like, yeah, like those kind of, like, Brett Boone came to the Twins during that time. And, mm-hmm. he would, after games, walk around the clubhouse with nothing on. And I mean, nothing. And just like, and would walk up to you and talk to you like, hey, you know, like, and it was just uncomfortable.
Right.
And, but it's like, things like that? I don't think those things happen anymore. I don't know if even people realize that, like, some of these things have even gone on behind the scenes or, like, in the clubhouse or in a locker room but you have to go in there. And I can't imagine just going in there and what that was even like for Kelly. Like, you know, and it's like, it's uncomfortable
for everybody.
Exactly.
For everybody. And the locker rooms are not a fun place for anyone.
I'm not even necessarily even saying, like the what you're wearing or what you're not wearing, but just the complete disrespect is more so. Like, did you ever face some of that? Do you think that maybe we've come a long way?
You know, as I say, every once in a while you hear.
Yeah.
And it's usually somebody who it is just like that hotshot, is trying to, you know, be cute,
yeah,
be funny. It's not funny. A clubhouse is like your office. It's their office.
Exactly.
It's their sanctuary. And clubhouses are sacred. Locker rooms are sacred to the people who play. And the idea that I go charging in there, whether they won, whether they lost, I go charging in there going, yeah, how do you feel? I mean, that whole premise, I don't care what you have on or not, that whole premise is kind of icky.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I don't mind these new rules that they bring players out. And so having said that, if he goes in, I go in. And no matter how comfortable, uncomfortable it is for me, if he goes in, I go in. And for years at Fox 19, I would cover after Bengals games when they were horrible. And Whitworth was always right as you went into the clubhouse. His locker was like right next to the door. And I love it. I love Whit. I mean, he's just a good person. And you knew you could get in to see him, and he would give you a quote, whether they won, lost, whether they got killed, whether, you know, whatever. He would give you a good quote. And it was when Shannon Russell was working.
The Inquirer, yeah.
And so Shannon and I would be there with photographers and other reporters, and we would all kind of like stand in a huddle. And we'd have like the guys kind of scan the room, said, all right, so-and-so's about dressed. Let's all go over there. And so we would like amoeba our whole, you know, circle. We would like amoeba over there all together. You know, it's kind of like the end shot of the Mary Tyler Moore Show when they like all went out together. We made sure that as best as we could, the players felt comfortable too. We didn't go up to them with just a towel on. Usually we would wait until they were, you know, 9/10 dressed, and then we would go over there. And things like that, yes, those instances do happen. Not like they used to.
Yeah.
And as I say, post-COVID, the rules are a little different, which is fine. You know, I always said, I don't know why they don't do it like tennis, you know, because tennis, you never go into that locker room. You talk about sacred. I mean, that thing is locked down. You never go into the locker room up here at the tennis tournament. They always bring them out. Fine with me. I don't care. I just have to have equal access.
Bingo.
And we our joke was that if you were a female, you made sure that you got a legal-sized pad, so when you held it up to take notes, you know, everything was blocked, no matter what.
And I share it because, you know, these are behind-the-scenes things that, you know, you've had to, in your professional environment, you know, that, you know, they see you in your broadcast, mm-hmm. in your story, but what happened behind the scenes, or what did you have to deal with or see or hopefully not see behind the scenes to obtain that story, right. Which, you know, maybe isn't, you know, in the old boys network for,
right.
You know,
well, you remember Sam Weish was, you know, one of those that was not necessarily a friend to females in the locker room.
Right.
But it's become, and I don't want to say it routine, because it's not. And as I say, every once in a while you hear of an instance. But these players, these officials, these front office people, they have grown up working with women.
Yep.
And if they respect you and if they respect your work, there's no problem at all. At least that's what I have found. I can't speak for everyone, but if you treat the job respectfully, if you treat the job as a job, and you're not there in this world of social media, you're not there to promote what you're doing, you're there to do a job. And I think that you will get the respect of the players, the officials, the front office. You will get their respect because they see that, okay, you're there to do your job, to tell your listeners, your viewers about what's going on. And that's what you have to do. And I let me slip in a very quick story about Billie Jean King. Billie Jean King, if you remember, she was here in town in 2010. She was being honored at one of the civil rights games that the Reds had.
Yep.
She was coming in town. And it was just when I was finishing the book, I go, oh, I've got to interview her. So again, oh, she's very busy. Oh, she's not going to have time. She's, you know, and so I'm going through her people. Then I'm going through MLB. Then I finally go through the Reds, my buddies at the Reds. I said, okay, what do I need to do? And so I got an email that said, be down in the tunnel in front of the Diamond Club at such and such a time. You can get her for 5 minutes. I go, I'm there. So we go down and did the interview. I think I squeezed 6.5 minutes out of it. Did the interview.
As one does.
As you do.
Make them tell you I got to go.
That's right.
Yep.
And so did the interview. Shook her hand. And I said, I know you've heard this 1,000 times. This isn't anything new, but I just want to thank you for everything that you have gone through. You talk about somebody who has blazed a trail. I want to thank you for everything you have gone through that allows me to do what I'm doing now in sports. And I thank you and I appreciate it. And she said, and she like grabbed my hand with both of hers. I was shaking her hand. She goes, that's great. But let me ask you something. How do they treat you here? And I had never had anybody ask me that. How do they treat you here? So I had to give her like a, you know, a 15 second synopsis of my career. I said, I've worked here for 20 years. I've worked with these guys. We've all grown up together. They know my work. They respect my work. And so, yes, they treat me very well. And she said, good. Pay it forward and pass it on. And that has stuck with me.
Is there a pivot point? You have done that. Is there a pivot point where you realized you have done that?
I don't think I ever got into this with the idea that it is something that I'd have to worry about. I figured by, you know, this time everybody is doing what they want to do and all that. Again, not necessarily the case as we know. I always had in the back of my mind I wanted to teach. And so, you know, that's one thing that I've enjoyed so much is being able to teach and have young women come up to me and say, you know, what did you do? What can I do?
Yeah.
What things do I need to do? How do I network? How do I do this? And I think that it's still something that we all have the responsibility for, whether you're in broadcast or not, whether you're in sports or not, whatever profession you are in. I always tell when I'm giving a speech like to a law firm, I said, it's nice if you're the first female partner, but don't be the only one. Don't be the last. It's your responsibility if you have that job. It's your responsibility now to bring up that next generation. And I don't care how you do it, whether you teach, whether you mentor, whether you have a cup of coffee, whatever you do, it is up to you if you get to a certain point in your career. It's up to you to bring up that next generation because I don't want to be the last. Even if I'm the first, I don't want to be the last. Gail Searens, if you remember her, Gail Searens was the first woman to call an NFL game years ago, 3-4 decades ago. And I interviewed her for the book, and she said, when I was interviewing her in 2008, 2009, she said, can you believe all these years there's still another female who has not called a regular season NFL game? Of course, that has changed now. We have had women in the booth doing the play-by-play. But for someone like a Gail Searens to be the only one after, you know, 30-some-odd years, you know, that's, yes, it was a breakthrough, but then there wasn't the next one. Pam Ward, who was the first at ESPN to call college
football, yeah,
Division I football. She did the Big Ten games with Chris Spielman for years, and she's a buddy of mine, and we worked together at ESPN. And I said, "How does it feel to be a trailblazer?" She said, "It's hard to be a trailblazer if there's no one behind you on the trail." So you need that next person. You need that, you know, Beth Mowins. You need, you know, that next generation to come up and do what you want to do, what you have enjoyed doing. And yes, maybe you were the first, but make sure that there's somebody else coming up behind you. You don't want to be the last. You don't want to be the only.
So you're still in the sports. You still do things with sports related, college related.
Yes, I still work for Fox 19, our buddies at Fox 19. I do a weekly segment on the morning show talking about what's coming up this week. And I'll do like for opening day or Bengals games, I'll do the morning shift. You know, it's hard to do that 11 o'clock news anymore. I think about that. I used to do the 11 o'clock news, not bad, and I go out and, you know, go to Tina's and shut
Tina's.
Down.
Oh, yeah.
Close down Tina's. You know, I can't do that
all
anymore.
Channel 5, folks.
Yeah,
Tina's
right. I know. You know, of course, you can't do that because Tina isn't there anymore. And second of all, I can't stay up that late. But, you know, I do the mornings with Fox 19. And it's really fun because it's very conversational. And it is really talking about what to watch this upcoming weekend. And so, you know, I enjoy that part.
But we haven't said, because you also started your own firm, Game Day. And can you, I want you to tell us a little bit about that, because Game Day is the wind beneath so many wings that we cover all of these events and everything. And Game Day is really there promoting them and coordinating all of the journalism around. So it's like kind of PR and helping us.
Well,
and Game Day, you guys, sends out a morning note every day, and it is the very first thing I do because it's all of the events coming up. It's something that maybe happened yesterday, a summation, and it's for the journalists to use in their broadcasts or come and cover. There's a press conference, and it's the best because you're getting like a sneak peek at everything that's coming up. It's like a glimpse into the future.
Well, we kind of pride ourselves in thinking that we know what journalists need.
You
know, the first thing in the morning. You need a synopsis. You need an idea of what's going on. You need a kind of a guide on how to plan your day and what you're going to cover. And you know, we're in our 22nd year, who'd have thunk. We have great people working with us. And it's one of these things that my business partner, Jackie Rowe, and I, we started it thinking that we would be more or less a traditional PR company. We had the idea that we wanted to do sports. A lot of people were doing sports at that time. A lot of people were in PR at that time, but nobody was really putting it together. And so we thought that we could put those two things together. Nobody else was doing that here in Cincinnati. And I was at ESPN, as you mentioned, and people say, why did you leave ESPN? I said, it's such a cliche, but it was 9/11. And we went through 9/11 very similar to what we went through COVID. During that time, people reevaluated their lives. What am I doing? Am I doing what I really want to do? Am I living where I really want to live? And at that time, I was flying back and forth every week to Bristol, Connecticut, coming back here because I was teaching at Xavier at the time, and ESPN was so gracious about letting me come back on my days off. They would work my days off so I would have either a Wednesday, Thursday, or Thursday, Friday off because I taught on Thursday evenings. So I would fly back. Well, after 9/11, flying was horrible. And you start reevaluating. Am I doing what I want to do? My mother at the time, she was in her early 80s. She was fine. But I knew that I needed to come back here to the area, start taking more care of her. And so, you know, those things kind of came together. And Jackie and I had had this idea in our heads about doing some kind of sports PR. And I said, well, if we're going to do it, let's do it. This is a good time to do it. And at the same time, the LPGA was looking to do a magazine show to kind of promote the LPGA. And Ty Votaw, Cincinnati boy, was the commissioner, and Libby was there, also from Cincinnati. She was their legal counsel, and they said, do you want to put together a magazine show about the LPGA and see if you can sell it? I said, sure. How hard can it be? How many times have I said that in my life? Well, we did. We did a preview of the Solheim Cup. It was more of a lifestyle magazine. We did a segment with Michelle Redman, one of the members of the Solheim Cup team that particular year. The Solheim Cup was going to be in Minnesota that year. And so we had Michelle Redman and the governor of Minnesota do nine holes. The governor of Minnesota at that particular time was Jesse Ventura. Jesse the Body Ventura. Jesse the Body Ventura, who used to be in WWF.
Always
back
entertaining.
Then. Yeah. Yes. So we asked, he said, sure. So mic'd him up, sent him out on the course, you know, hysterical. It was great. But put together this half-hour lifestyle show. We were a few years ahead of our time. Couldn't sell it then, but we got the experience and we got the bug. And our first paying client, it's a Flying Pig Marathon, and we are so thankful and gracious and honored to still be working with them.
From day one, right?
Yeah, from day one. And, you know, such a resource and a jewel that we have in this city is the Flying Pig Marathon and how it brings our community together. And I always say there's 40,000 runners and each person has a story and everyone is happy. I don't care if you do a 1 mile, if you do 5 miles, if you do a marathon, everyone is happy. And how many sporting events do you go to that that happens? You know, somebody wins, somebody loses, somebody's not happy leaving. But at a marathon, everyone is happy and they are so proud of themselves doing this. And so we are so thankful and grateful that we are still working with the Flying Pig.
And how it's grown.
Oh, my word. How it's grown. Yeah. That was like one of our first things. They had never had 50 states. They'd never had 50 states. So this particular year, that was our goal. We were going to get all 50 states. And the only state we didn't have was South Dakota.
I was going to guess Alaska, but all right.
No, Alaska's always first. It's okay. Always the Dakotas. Sometimes Wyoming is the last, but this year it was South Dakota. So we're going, who do you know in South Dakota? Nobody knows anybody. So we're like calling our friends at Xavier and UC, and do you know anybody in South Dakota? But somebody knew somebody who was in the athletic department at South Dakota State. And so, you know, the assistant athletic director goes down the hall and says, hey, does anybody want to run a marathon next weekend in Cincinnati? Kid pops his head out. Yeah, I will. So we put together our Delta Miles, got him a free hotel room, got him a free entry. And, you know, the kid comes in here and he runs like a 3:45 marathon, you know,
through the hills of Cincinnati.
And we did a whole to-do about this is the first year that all 50 states. And we had a delegation at the airport and we had a little South Dakota flags. I still have mine on my desk. You know, it was just great. But yeah, it has grown so much and people have really embraced it as a thing to do. You know that there are Cincinnati things that are the thing to do, and you do them. You go across the Anderson Ferry because it's a thing to do. You do this and that because it's a thing to do. And the Flying Pig Marathon has become the thing to do. Whether it's a marathon, whether it's 5K, whatever. It's become such a cultural and community event. We're so blessed to be able to work with them.
I have one more question. So ESPN is... changed a lot since you were there, to say the least. Of course, I think most media companies have. Do you still watch it? What do you make of ESPN today?
Some of my buddies are still there. Not many anymore. Yeah. But Butcher Gross is still there. And, you know, there's a handful of people that I work with who are still there. It is... When I started ESPN... I always say it's the only place that I've ever worked that you read what you wrote. Most of the times there are producers or the reporters who will read or write the leads for you and then you read their stuff. At ESPN, it was the only place that you wrote everything that you read on the anchor desk. You had to, when I went in to interview, they gave you the SportsCenter script of the night before, rewrite it, and anchor the first segment. So you rewrote it. The good thing is that you put it in your own voice. You know what the script says, so it's easier for you to write and read. And the people who started ESPN, they all came from journalism. They came from newspaper. They came from magazine. They were journalists. They were writers. They were storytellers. And they put such a high premium on writing, which I loved. I absolutely loved. And they really were the first to present sports as news.
Yep.
It was a half hour newscast. It just happened to all be sports. And you know, back then it was like this, wow, you know, who'd have thunk that? But because of that, I think that it became this resource. Everybody watched SportsCenter. Everybody, you know, watched the 11 o'clock SportsCenter because that was the wrap up of the day.
Absolutely.
And now, again, as you mentioned, things have changed.
Yeah.
Now I don't have to wait for SportsCenter to see the score, to see the highlights. Get it on my phone. I can watch anything that I want. I can watch sports that they're not going to talk about on SportsCenter. So it has become entertainment. We have seen some of the big contracts that have been given out. We have seen some great journalists in Bristol be let go. Yep. Susie Colbert has forgotten more about football than I'll ever know.
Oh, yeah.
And the journalists in me, I hate the fact that so many good people are not there anymore telling these stories. Because that's what separates you as a journalist, especially in sports. Sports is linear. The game starts. This is what happened in the game. The game ends. You do a preview. You say what happened. You wrap it up. It's very linear. When you're a storyteller, it's not necessarily linear. The high school team is getting ready for the finals. They get to the locker room. They find out that something has happened to their uniforms. They're gone. Okay, there's a dip in that story. So what do? They find out that so-and-so is an alum. At the last minute, they find uniforms. The story comes back up.
Yep.
And then they get to the high school finals. You have told a story that is not necessarily linear. It's up and down. It's up and down. Those stories will stick with people much longer than the score of a game. Did you hear about the high school that they got their uniforms are all stolen like the night before the big game and blah, 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 and they had to scrounge. And people will remember that story. Well, who won? Oh. You know what? I don't know, but isn't that a great story? Mm-hmm. Storytelling will last much longer than the scores. And to not have those storytellers there, it does bother me, but I also know on the other side, it's a business. It's a show.
Yeah.
It's a show. And it's entertainment.
Yep.
Yeah, it's got a sports bent. But it's entertainment now. And so I understand that from a business perspective, from a journalism perspective. I hate the fact that so many of those storytellers aren't there anymore telling their stories.
I mean, yeah, the whole industry. I mean, I think newsrooms, this newsroom, yeah. Like we're trying to like find your spot and your mm-hmm. place in this new, I mean, this ever, not new, it's not new anymore, but this right. ever changing.
And you know it will. It will all shake out. I mean, when television came about, radio didn't go away. It evolved. Right. And the same thing happens with local news. Local news, the advantage of local news is it's local.
Yep.
You can tell those stories locally. You won't necessarily get the Walnut Hills score on ESPN, but you'll get it locally. You know, our advantage is local.
Yep.
And that's what you have to really emphasize, because you will always have that local audience. Again, are they tuning in? Are they reading the newspaper? Are they getting it on their phone? Whatever way they get it, it's our responsibility as local journalists to emphasize that local part. That's where they get their information. And that's what we have to emphasize. It'll all shake out. We'll all evolve. We'll all figure it out, you know. But our job is really to tell those local stories. And storytelling, not everybody is a good storyteller. And if you tell a great story, it means so much that you can tell those stories. Because grandma still cuts those clippings out of the newspaper.
This is true. You guys, I can't tell you how many people are like
handwritten letters.
And people that you would think that wouldn't ask are like, can I get a copy of that?
Yes.
You know, and yes. like the PDF and like the nice page and want to keep it. And
yes. Like, I mean, our clients like that newspaper clipping. I mean, there's something tangible about that. You know, I get my newspaper, I get my Inquirer every morning. And
we appreciate that. That's still the day job, but we're delivering news in a different way with the right. podcast. We want to be on all the platforms.
Exactly. Inquirer
as a TikTok. But thank you for getting the newspaper.
Exactly. But, you know, it evolves. We'll all figure it out. Today it's TikTok. Tomorrow it'll be something else that we don't even know. And we'll evolve. We'll figure it out. We'll go to where that audience is. And the audience, you know, it changes. It moves on us. And we've got to follow where the audience is. But we'll find the audience. And more importantly, the audience will find us if we're telling those great stories. The audience will find us.
I'm thinking about the advice Billie Jean King gave you. So I'm going to throw that, do a little role reversal. In some ways, like, she wasn't, you didn't ask her for journalism advice, but bear with me. So if you were to walk out of this room right now, we got a room full of interns and several young reporters, very talented young reporters. But if they were one of them or all of them were to come to you and say, I want to do this for my career, what's your elevator speech advice? to a young wannabe reporter, journalist, broadcaster?
At Ball State, this was before David Letterman spent a lot of money to fix up the telecommunications program. So I was in journalism, but at Ball State, you had the opportunity to do so much while you were still on campus. And so that's the first thing that I always say, especially if somebody is still in school. Get as much experience as you can now. And like at Ball State, they have a department called Sports Link. And these kids do stories connected with the athletic department. And they're really kind of the PR arm for the athletic department. And they get such great experience. They get to go to the Olympics. They get to go to the NCAA tournament. They just went to Cardiff in Wales and did features on athletes of all abilities in Cardiff. You know, one of these old industrial towns is just on you know, its last legs, and did a feature on 8 athletes there. What a great experience. Are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. I told the head of the department, I said, I am so jealous of what they do. So get as much experience as you can there. I also, this last semester, I had the amazing opportunity. I taught a class at Notre Dame. It's called Game Day Media, believe it or not. I had nothing to do with the name of that class, but it's called Game Day Media. And basically it was for student athletes who may not play pro, but they want to continue in their sport. And so teaching play-by-play, teaching color analysts, teaching podcasts, things like that, so they can do stuff connected with their sport once they graduate. And one of my students is the son of Tom Rinaldi. Again, a wonderful storyteller. Yeah. I saw an interview that he did at the All-Star Game. He works for Fox now, worked for years for ESPN, works for Fox now. And I had him come into my class. And he said the most important thing that you can have on your resume is the word "and." I can write, and I can edit, and I can shoot, and I can do this and that and the other. So the most important word you can have on your resume is "and." Because it's just like if you're a baseball player and all you play is second base. Have you ever played third? No. Would you switch to third? Now, most infielders can move around. They can move on that on the left side of the infield. But the most important thing you can have in your back pocket is versatility, that you can do different things. When we all got into journalism, we never thought that we would be doing something like this. We never thought that we would be posting stuff on a website, and what's a website, and you know, we never thought that we would be doing anything like that. We never thought that we would be taking pictures with our phone, taking video with our phone, and posting it. But it's what we have learned. We've put that "and" on our experience. And I can do podcasts, and I can take video on my phone, and I can edit it, and I can upload it, and you can have it on your website in 5 minutes. Most important word that you can have is and do as many things as you can to get that experience. And I don't care if you decide you don't want to be a producer. That's fine. Find out while you're in college that you don't want to be a producer. Yep. Throw that out. Who cares? Nobody cares. And then go find something that, you know, again, like for me, it took my last quarter of my last year at Ball State to figure out that this is what I wanted to do. So the most important word you can have on that resume for those young people who are out there in your newsroom is and. Do as much as you can. Be as versatile as you can. Be as valuable as you can.
Now, we could talk because that's like... Oh,
and I wanted to sit here and talk about Reese Hines. I mean, come on.
I'm just like, preach that, because that was exactly the advice I got from, I was a stringer at the sport at the Cincinnati Post then, and the sports editor at the time, because I was hungry and I'm like, and I annoyed the heck out of him. But I was like, what can I do? And he was like, make yourself as versatile as possible. Mm-hmm. And that still rings. And that's exactly what you're saying.
Right.
To hear that, that was in 1997.
Yeah. And I did that when I was at the South Bend Tribune. I mean, it was, I got in the tail end of just before digital, we were still shooting film. I had never shot film on a regular basis, and I certainly had not developed film. And you learn that. You teach yourself to shoot film, and you learn how to develop those photographs and turn them into the newspaper. So you it depends on how hungry you are, and you both know how many sacrifices you have to make to be in this business. And you work weekends, you work holidays. I can't tell you how many times I've had Thanksgiving dinner from White Castle. It happens.
In the newsroom on Christmas.
Yeah, in the newsroom on Christmas.
In a hotel room in Arizona covering a bowl game on Christmas.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you make sacrifices to be in this business, but we wouldn't make those sacrifices if we didn't love it, if we weren't passionate about it, if this was not something that we had a burning desire to do. And again, I would rather that you find out while you're in college that I don't want to work weekends. All right, that's fine. Do something else, but find out now that you don't want to do that. And, you know, no judgment, that's fine. You know, I hate the fact that, you know, so many times you see, you know, because we all post everything, we overshare.
Literally on my to-do list today is to have to social media some things that I've written and everything. That's like something I have to do.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, this was my dream job. And I thank so-and-so for bringing me back home. And this was my dream job. But I'm here to announce that I'm leaving my dream job. And
I've seen a lot of that.
I mean, you see that all the time.
Yep.
Because...
I do think something very special about you is that you do still have your dream job. You started this company, you're doing something different, and you did pivot, but you have stayed with what you love. And you do still do it.
I do. And I love working with Fox 19, and you know, we are the Bengals station now. So so you know, it's so much fun, and it keeps me involved, and frankly, it keeps me up to date with the technology, because again,
this is true.
You know, technology changes all the time. So it's nice that I have that refresher that I know what the technology is and what people are using and what they're doing.
We just had a big lesson in AI, not using it in journalism, but what it means for fact checking, and it's coming.
It is. I mean, it again, it changes every day. I mean, you've got to keep up with it.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Love seeing you out in the field, and like, this was such a good conversation.
Thank you.
And you guys, I highly recommend reading her book. It's just, it was a good, quick read. It's very conversational. So Playing Ball with the Boys, The Rise of Women in Men's Sports.
Thank you, Betsy.
Thank you both. I appreciate it.
Thanks again to Betsy Ross for joining us here today. Sherry, I know they say keep podcasts to a short time frame about a person's commute, but
do they?
Gosh, dog, like we could have still been sitting here talking with Betsy. I had so many more questions I want to ask her about, so much respect for her. And, you know, as we were sitting here talking to her, one of the things I thought of was our very own Kelsey Conway, our Bengals beat reporter. And, Kelsey, you still think about women in sports media. Though there's been, you know, so many women go into sports media, it's still there's still not that many women in sports media, and I have so much respect for those who are.
Like a main beat writer for one of the NFL yeah. teams.
Like Kelsey is awesome. She's a great teammate.
She's a hustler. You got to be on that beat.
She breaks all the news on injuries and player contracts, and does a Bengals Beat podcast down the hallway, so to speak.
With Phil.
Actually, it's right in here. But so just shout out to Kelsey. We appreciate her and the work that she does covering the Bengals.
All right. Well, Jace,
is it that time?
It is. It is. You remember this time?
Yeah, I do. I love this time.
Yes, I know. That's so Cincinnati.
This is a Burrow baby right here.
Yeah.
I remember when he said, what about a That's So Cincinnati moment of the week? And Phil, then at one point you had like little sound effects for that, like a little drum roll.
He's like, shh.
He's like, sure.
Don't make more work for me.
They still call you Silent Phil over there?
Yeah. Yeah, he chimed in. He was very helpful when it came to the Kelsey brothers and the garage beer. We were talking about that. And Phil, he knew all the things. And so he was helpful there. So he chimes in sometimes.
He knows his beer. He knows his beer.
Yep.
Beer, podcasts, soundboards, drones with video cameras on it.
Speaking of all the ways we do journalism today.
Every drone has a video camera, right? I mean, otherwise, what's the point? Is it that time?
It is. It is. You're awfully tan.
This is a Cincinnati moment of the week. I spent my week and a half, almost 2 weeks down at Hilton Head.
As all Cincinnatians do.
My parents live down in that area now, Beaufort County, right off the island in Bluffton. So we usually go down now 2-3 times a year. But I had never done this before, and I like researched before we went, like, why do so many people from Ohio go? And I actually found the story why. Like, so there was back in the 70s, a developer who developed Sea Pines, which, like, of course, most people in Ohio, I'm joking. Like, you know, it feels like everyone in Ohio goes to Hilton Head, but Sea Pines just one of the areas of Hilton Head. And he was developing that, and he's like, how do we get people to come here where it's a drivable? It's still within a day's drive, and it's from a place that's cold weather. And for whatever, the stories that I found didn't necessarily say like why they honed in on Ohio. And maybe it's because like a lot of Ohioans go to Florida, so maybe they could kind of cut their trip short. So they did a massive marketing effort in Cincinnati, Columbus, Cleveland, Toledo, billboards, all kinds of advertising in the media. And then that's what started all these Ohioans going to Hilton Head back in the 70s. And literally every other car license plate is from Ohio now.
Have you ever run into anyone you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like almost every time I'm there, usually we'll see someone that I know or that I know of.
And you drive,
yep.
right?
And we drive, yep.
Drive. How many marathon conversations have we had while you're driving? A lot.
A lot, yeah.
A lot. Because I know you're trapped in the car.
10 hours, yeah. Made it in less than 10 from my parents, which they live 15 minutes from the island. So it's a little shorter, but made it in 9 hours and 52 minutes because I did my timer.
Do Bethany and the kids fly and stay longer than you?
Sometimes they will do Allegiant because it's cheap, so they'll fly. Then I'll drive down, and so we have a car, and I'll bring all the gear because, you know, Allegiant charges you for every single thing. So I'll take all the luggage and the baggage and drive. But we didn't do that this time, and there's a lot of benefit in having everyone. It's much more pleasant to drive by yourself.
Yes. And anyone with kids.
I love driving.
Anyone with kids knows.
Yeah.
All right. That is a great That's So Cincinnati moment. All right, you guys. Thank you for listening.
One more thing. We need a skyline there.
Oh,
Dick Williams. Dick Williams, if you're listening.
I did hear they're expanding.
We need a skyline there.
So that would be a very good place. Look at you. All right. Jason, I'll be his agent on this one. If there's
maybe I can run it. I don't know.
There were some big stories in the media. They are expanding.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And that was a big conversation where people were like, people won't understand it. But if there was we're kind of big Florida people, and there is one skyline there. But we would eat skyline on vacation. Our child loves it. Like, that's something that we would do.
I think there's one in Fort Myers, right?
Yep.
Dick Williams is doing an awesome job at Skyline, really, really growing the company. So, yeah.
All right. Well, good idea.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for listening, you guys.